You're listening to sermons from Bethany Baptist Church. For more information, visit us at bethanychicago.org.
We're reading in the book of Matthew, chapter 14, verses 13 through 36. Now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Now, when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves." But Jesus said, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." They said to him, "We have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish." And he said, "Bring them here to me." Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass, and taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing. Then he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces left over. And those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. Immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost," and they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." And when they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret. And when the men that place recognized him, they sent around to all that region and brought him all who were sick, and implored him that they might only touch the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched, it were made well.
Mateo capítulo 14, versículo 13 al 36 dice, oyéndolo Jesús, se apartó de ahí en una barca a un lugar desierto y apartado. Y cuando la gente lo oyó, le siguió a pie desde las ciudades. Y saliendo Jesús, vio una gran multitud y tuvo compasión de ellos y sanó a los que de ellos estaban enfermos. Cuando anochecía, se acercaron a él sus discípulos diciendo, "El lugar es desierto y la hora ya pasada. Despide a la multitud para que vayan por las aldeas y compren de comer." Jesús les dijo, "No tienen necesidad de irse. Dadle vosotros de comer." Y ellos dijeron, "No tenemos aquí sino 5 panes y 2 peces. Él les dijo, "Traédmelos acá." Entonces mandó a la gente recostarse sobre la hierba, y tomando los 5 panes y los 2 peces, y levantando los ojos al cielo, bendijo y partió y dio los panes a los discípulos y los discípulos a la multitud. Y comieron todos y se saciaron y recogieron lo que sobró de los pedazos, 12 cestas llenas. Y los que comieron fueron como 5,000 hombres, sin contar las mujeres y los niños. Enseguida Jesús hizo a sus discípulos entrar en la barca e ir delante de él a la otra ribera. Entre tanto que él despedía a la multitud. Despedida la multitud, subió al monte a orar aparte. Y cuando llegó la noche, estaba ahí solo. Y ya la barca estaba en medio del mar, azotada por las olas, porque el viento era contrario. Mas a la cuarta vigilia de la noche, Jesús vino a ellos andando sobre el mar, y los discípulos, viéndole andar sobre el mar, se turbaron, diciendo, «Un fantasma», y dieron voces de miedo. Pero enseguida Jesús les habló, diciendo, «Tened ánimo, soy yo, no temáis». Entonces le respondió Pedro, y dijo, «Señor, si eres tú, manda que yo vaya a ti sobre las aguas». Y él dijo, «Ven». Y descendiendo Pedro de la barca, andaba sobre las aguas para ir a Jesús. Pero al ver el fuerte viento, tuvo miedo y comenzó a hundirse. Dio voces diciendo, «Señor, sálvame». Al momento Jesús extendió la mano, asió de él y le dijo, «Hombre de poca fe, ¿por qué dudaste?». Y cuando ellos subieron en la barca, se calmó el viento. Entonces los que estaban en la barca vinieron y le adoraron, diciendo, «Verdaderamente eres el Hijo de Dios». Y terminada la travesía, vinieron a tierra de Genezaret. Cuando le conocieron los hombres de aquel lugar, enviaron noticias por toda aquella tierra alrededor y trajeron a él a todos los enfermos y le rogaban que le dejasen tocar solamente el borde de su manto. Y todos los que le tocaron quedaron sanos. Amén.
I'm not sure if any of you have actually played any formal sports, maybe when you were younger, or maybe you are younger. I know we have a couple that are in sports now and entering. And in my very humble opinion, the absolute worst part of being in any kind of athletic, maybe team event, I guess, specifically, is the summertime right before the season starts when you start to practice. Because there's this section of the training that people call conditioning. And as we all know, the conditioning is the absolute worst. So I played soccer a lot growing up, and I loved soccer. I loved running around, kicking a ball, knocking people over, taking things, scoring goals, doing whatever. Like, that was cool. But I wasn't a runner. Like, I ran a ton, but I only like to run with a purpose, which is more than just, like, get from here to there faster. Like, I had to get there faster to get the ball, to be able to steal it and, you know, score. That was the point. Or stop them from scoring. So during conditioning, you just run a lot for a really long time. And if you're in, say, football, you might, like, run with, like, weights and be pushing stuff. Or if you play any other sport, you're doing that. You're just running a lot. Working hard, maybe lifting weights, whatever it is, but it's not really the thing that you want to be doing. It's the thing you have to do to get ready for the thing you're going to do, because no one wants to be on the soccer field and run and get exhausted before they can even get to the ball and pass out. You have to be in shape. And I remember during these conditioning times, like, we all kind of knew there was a reason for this, but we also all sort of hated our coaches because they made us do it. It was like, really? Another one? Like, another lap? Like, we have to keep going? You want us to go now you're yelling at us because we're not going fast enough? Like, and the coach has to, like, motivate and kind of force, and, like, they're really putting you through a lot of pain that you don't necessarily want to go through as a coach. And the pain that they, like, put on their team is for a purpose, and it's for a reason, but when you're in the middle of it, you kind of just want to give up, and you really are debating whether or not it's even worth it to be on the team. You know, do I really want to play again this year, or could I get some time back and, you know, play video games or something at home? There's no conditioning involved in that. With all of that said, I think the reason I bring this up is because conditioning is an essential part of any sport. And really anything you do, you have to be disciplined enough to work hard at it. And normally in that disciplined part where you're forcing yourself to endure the difficulty because you know there's some sort of a prize at the end, it's not the pain itself is never fun. And in this text today, we see that the disciples specifically put in multiple situations that are pretty awkward, difficult, and tiring for them. And Jesus does this to them. This is something that as I was reading and studying this passage, really stuck out to me. In every single one of these situations, if you notice, Jesus does this to his disciples. And Jesus, in this text, he reveals himself as the saving Son of God through the trials that come from people following him. Again, he reveals himself as the saving Son of God through trials caused by people who are trying to be obedient to him. Jesus caused their problems, and then Jesus reveals himself. That's the pattern we see in this text. And so I'm going to break it up into three parts. It's probably not the best way to break it up. It's just long, so we got to break it up somewhere. So I'm going to start with the feeding at the first part, so 13 to 21. And then we'll look at him walking, 22 to 27. And then we'll look at him saving, 28 through 36. So if we start with verse 13 in this passage, we see that Jesus hears something, and because of that, he does something. And so this is alluding to the text that Nathan preached a couple weeks ago, where Jesus is finding out that Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus, and he said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him." And then Matthew does a little flashback for us to fill in a little bit of history. And Matthew tells us that the reason that Herod said this is because Herod put John to death for John's faithfulness to God. And so here, in this text, we find out, as a flashback to verses 1 and 2 of chapter 14, that Jesus has heard now that he's caught the attention of Herod. The guy that just killed John, Herod Antipas, finds out about Jesus and thinks, oh no, John's come back from the dead. And so now, as Jesus hears this, that Herod is taking an interest in him, after he's already killed John, Jesus decides he's going to withdraw. So this is kind of a strategic move by Jesus. He knows it's not his time yet, he's not supposed to die yet, and so he's trying to get away. And he decides that he also wants to get away by himself to a desolate place. And what that really just means is a place where there's not any development. He didn't go to a town. He didn't go to a nice little summer resort on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. He was going to find a place where there wasn't anyone around. He wanted some quiet time to think and to pray and to have some peace and to get away from the crowds and all of the ministry that he's been doing. But it says that he wants to go alone, and depending on how you read this text or how the translation goes into English, what it really just means is that he's trying to get to some place that's isolated by himself. He's not necessarily by himself. His disciples are with him in the boat. But he wants to get to a place where he can be alone. But the problem with this is that Jesus is a famous guy, and people love him, and they really want him and what he has to offer them in terms of miracles and teachings and healings and everything like that. So as soon as Jesus decides he's going to have a little bit of a retreat to get away from the potential threat of Herod and to go and to see a little different area where he can pray and consider what's next for his ministry, as he's trying to do that, the crowds catch wind of it. They see him, and they start following him. And what you need to know, I guess, and I'll tell you this now, is that this entire, if the Sea of Galilee is like a big kind of circular thing that's pretty good size, you know. All of these stories happen like right around the little top north ring of it. So he's not going across it. The people aren't running all the way around this. They're going maybe 4 to 5 miles in any direction along the shoreline in this story. And so the people who are in his hometown in, you know, Capernaum and those areas where he's been doing most of his ministry, because he's no longer in Nazareth at this point, they find out, and so they just migrate along the shore to follow him, maybe 4 or 5 mile walk along the shore, and then catch him when he gets off the boat. So, of course, Jesus, wanting to escape, sees this crowd, and we are told when they come to him on foot, it's a huge crowd, but he has compassion on them, in verse 14, which is amazing. He's trying to get away. He's trying to go on a retreat, and the people follow him, and yet Jesus has compassion. And we're told that, and this is a echo of what we were told earlier, that Jesus has compassion on the crowds because he sees they're harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Jesus cared about these people. And so although he was trying to get away from them, he still had compassion on them. And so he's doing healings, he's among the crowds, and we'll see this here and at the end. He's not like some elite who separates himself and acts like he's better and must keep a distance from like the unwashed mobs. No, he's among them. He's healing them. He's caring for them. And Matthew specifically calls out here the healings, not teachings this time around. But then as this is going on and the disciples and Jesus are trying to be on their retreat and the crowds come to get them, the day gets long. It starts to get towards nighttime. The sun's going to set soon. And the disciples are very logical, rational, normal human beings. And they think, we're all out here basically in this desolate place. And by desolate, it's not a desert. You're not supposed to, we're told there's grass there, so we're not supposed to think of this as like they're going to starve, it's dry or anything like that. The people will be fine. The disciples are just saying, send them home. Like, get them out of here. They need to go get food. Like, we're miles away from town. Let's have them all go back. We're not just going to all camp out here through the night. And so, the disciples say this. It makes a lot of sense. You would think that Jesus would agree and send the group home several miles to go get food and sleep in their own beds for the night. But Jesus doesn't. He creates a dilemma. If you look at that, he creates a problem for the disciples. And Jesus looks at them in verse 16. He says, they don't need to go away. You give them something to eat. Which, I don't know, if you're a disciple in this situation, again, this is super awkward. Jesus is telling you to do something that you don't know how to do. You literally have no idea what he's talking about. This is the first kind of feeding miracle that he's going to do. And so if you put yourself in their shoes, they're just like, wait, why? What is going on here? Because Jesus doesn't want to send the crowds off. He cares for them, and he wants to show that he's going to provide for them. He wants to have a big family meal together with this multitude. And so the disciples, he also wants to get used to being in leadership roles and providing for a crowd. So he tells the disciples, you do it. You figure it out. And of course, there's more details in the other Gospels if you want to look them up. But basically, the disciples are running around looking, and they find a little kid. And we're not told about the kid here at all or anything, but they got a little bit of food. 5 loaves, 2 fish. Maybe they could feed, you know, a couple dozen people or something with this food at most. A little snack. And yet, that's all they found. Again, they have a dilemma. What are we going to do? They bring it all to Jesus, and they tell Jesus, this is all we've got. And he says, okay, bring it to me. That's fine. And then he tells everybody to sit down. This isn't just a snack he's handing out. Again, Jesus wants a family meal. And the situation is interesting because they have the 5 loaves, they have the 2 fish. He brings it down, he has them all sit down, and he basically goes through all of the kind of rituals or routine of a standard family meal at that time in a Jewish household. He takes them, he looks up to heaven as if he were the father or the patriarch of a little family sitting around a table, and he says a blessing. He prays. He thanks God. And you can look it up. There are standard blessings. But basically, he's just praising God for the provision of this tiny little meal for this massive crowd. And then we don't know what happens. He starts to break it up. He has the people sit down. They're going to be there for a while. And then he has his disciples take the stuff. And we don't know how this works. It's obviously miraculous. And any attempt to avoid that just doesn't do justice to the text. Matthew clearly wants us to see that this is a miraculous event. We don't know. Somehow, as he's breaking, as he's handing, bread is multiplying, it's getting out, it's going to the disciples. The disciples are distributing all of this food to this crowd. Amazingly. Some kind of blessing from God distributed through the disciples to all the people so that they all eat and they're satisfied. And then after they're satisfied, the disciples go around and I don't know if each disciple had their own basket or how this worked, but then they went around to grab the leftover food because there was so much food that they thought they should collect the leftovers. And they do, and they have 12 baskets for the 12 disciples, 12 baskets representing the 12 tribes of Israel. And I don't think this is an accident. 12 is a very important symbolic number in the Bible. 12 is the symbolic number for all of God's people. And especially for Israel. And all of these miracles right here are taking place within lands where the Jews had settled. He's doing this among a Jewish audience. He's going to transition out of his ministry to the Jewish audience next time, and we'll also see that in the feeding of the 4,000, he's probably primarily with non-Jews. But here, feeding 5,000 people, there's 12 baskets left over, showing that God has an abundant provision enough for all of his people. And again, the 5,000, we're told, are just men, not including women and children. So there's probably at least 3 to 4 times, if not more, people that were fed miraculously in this situation. Now, if you were a Jew at this time, or if you're a reader of Matthew's gospel at this time, this happens. It's miraculous. It's amazing. But not only that, but it would make you start thinking, it would remind you of other things that God has done in the past. And you would remember that when God's people were in the wilderness and didn't have enough food, God provided them. He gave them manna. He brought birds and everything in, and the people were fed in the wilderness. So Jesus does this in this event, this miracle, as a sign. The fact that there are 12 left over is a sign. The fact that there are a bunch of people being fed divinely, miraculously, in a place where they can't buy food is a sign that God himself has come to prepare for his people. So we saw that again in Exodus chapter 16. I don't need to go back and read it, but most of us know this story. God brought his people out of Egypt. They were in a desolate place. They had no chance for food. Their water was running out, and he provided. God provides for his people, and here Jesus as God provides for his people. And then there's also another story that's kind of similar to this in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 4, where Elisha, the prophet, did a similar thing. And as if you are a Jew at this time, you would also know that there were promises from God to do this sort of thing again in the future. In the book of Isaiah, chapter 25 and verse 6, Isaiah says, and I'll just read one little section of this, and this is a prophecy about when God's Messiah will come, when God is going to make all things right, when death will have no existence anymore, when this eternal kingdom of the Messiah, God, will come and make all things right. And in the midst of it, it says, on this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich foods, a feast of well-aged wine, and of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. God's seating his people and feeding them as a way to point back to what God has done through Moses and through God's power in the wilderness, what he's doing now through Jesus, and then pointing forward to what God is going to do in the end through Jesus, this Messiah, for all of his people. And the other thing I want to mention here today, and again, this is God's doing and not mine, is that we are going to participate in communion in the Lord's Supper today. And John's gospel uses this, and even here in Matthew, if you read this, the same language, this language of Jesus taking the bread, looking up to heaven, blessing it, breaking it, these combination of words and actions only really happen a few times in the Bible. And in the New Testament, when those things happen, it's either on the road to Emmaus when people recognize Jesus as God, or when he's at his final meal with the disciples, and he says, "Do this in remembrance of me." And so what we're doing today is a reminder of what Jesus did here and also looking forward to what Jesus does in the future, that God spiritually provides for his people, and he does that through his Son, this saving Son who's revealing himself through this crazy situation in the desert where the disciples are put in a dilemma that they can't manage on their own. And he wants the people to share the meal together to show their union under God as God's family, and that's exactly what we do when we participate in communion. And we all look forward to this future meal in Isaiah 25, where Jesus will perfectly provide for and perfectly satisfy his people. So there we go. We've got the feeding behind us. But Jesus continues on with this. So immediately after this story, right when this happens, we're told in other gospels that some crazy stuff unfolds as soon as this happens. In John's gospel, we're told that immediately. And so Jesus, right after feeding the disciples, look at this in verse 22. I'll just read it. He says, "Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself. When evening came, he was there alone, but the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, 'It is a ghost.' And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, 'Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid.'" So notice he feeds them. The crowds are satisfied. They have tons of food left over. But immediately Jesus tells the disciples, he commands them, he makes them, depending on how your translation reads, he's getting them out of there. Get in the boat, get out of here. Go back. Go to the other side, go to a different place. Again, we need to look at the other Gospels. If you look at John's Gospel, the reason for this, you know, is because the people see Jesus, feed them, and they want to make him king right now. And we've seen that Jesus is retreating. He's trying to avoid being made a king, made a political leader on purpose. And right here, the people want to do it. So Jesus hurries so his disciples don't get any ideas and tells them, get out of there. And then Jesus gets in this big argument with the crowd, and Matthew just tells us that he dismisses them. He, in some way, escapes from them. He gets away from them. They all decide they're going to go home, and he makes it by himself up on a mountain. And he goes to that mountain and finally gets the quiet time that he had been planning on. He finally gets the alone time where he can pray and try to figure out what's next for his ministry now that not only the religious leaders, but the political leaders are taking an interest in him. And so he's up on that mountain praying. And we say, and if you read the ESV, it says, when evening came, towards the end of verse 23. You could also translate that to mean when it was really late, like when it got late, like much later. So it was already evening when he was beginning to do the feeding. The people must be walking home in the dark or something, and Jesus is up on the mountain in the dark, and he's made his disciples go out to see in the dark. He's up on that mountain for a long time that night, praying for hours and hours when it's late. And we're told later that it was the fourth watch of the night. And for those of you who don't measure your nights by watches, that is from about 3 to 6 a.m. So we're talking really, really early morning. Jesus finally decides to take a break from his all-night prayer. And while this is going on, again, think, if you're the disciples during this situation, Jesus just fed a bunch of people, you did all this stuff, and then he tells you to get out and go and cross. But as he's off by himself enjoying his nice time alone praying, they're out all night long in a boat fighting for their lives. We're told that there are strong winds. Jesus created, again, another dilemma for his disciples. They probably wouldn't have gotten in the boat in the middle of the night. Well, I mean, why? Just wait till morning. I mean, they just ate. They could probably sleep. Maybe they could even sleep on the boat, you know, docked at shore, whatever. But he made them get in the water and told them to go somewhere else. He created another problem. And they didn't get very far, we're told, but they're somehow driven out far enough from land that they're terrified and they're fighting. And the way that this reads, they're basically being assaulted by the water. Fighting strong winds, harassed by waves, almost as if the wind and the waves have a mind of their own. And back then, they probably thought there's some sort of a demonic evil force here bringing down pressure on us. And often people have looked at this story and seen the 12 disciples in a boat in a hard situation and seen this as a nice picture of the church out struggling in a situation that Jesus creates for them. And I think that that's a good way for us to look at this. They're out deep. They're fighting strong winds. They're harassed by waves. They're fighting. They want to obey. They want to be faithful. They could just get up, you know, give up and go back to the other side or wherever the winds are pushing them. But they don't. They keep going all night long, fighting. They're wet. They're tired, trying to be faithful and failing at it. And Jesus is nowhere to be seen. And I wonder if we can often relate to this one as well. We're trying to be faithful. We're trying to do what Jesus told us. And it's not working out. They're doing exactly what he said. And they think they're going to die. And then the weirdest thing happens. Jesus comes down from the mountain, apparently, and he comes walking across the water, which is also just really weird. I mean, if you think of this story, like, why? And if you're them and you're in the middle of this and you think there's some demonic forces or something crazy, like the waves are like they've never seen, the winds, like they can't even get anywhere, and they're fighting, and then a thing appears, and they think it's a ghost. They scream, they cry, what is this thing? Crazy. I mean, it would be crazy if this happened. If I saw someone walking at me in the middle of a storm off of Lake Michigan, I would be terrified. And that's exactly what happens to them. It's a ghost! But then, of course, it's just Jesus, for some reason, walking on the water. And Jesus says, take courage. It's me. Like, calm down. Don't be afraid. But let's look at this a little closer. He literally says, have courage. I am. Don't fear. Have courage. I am. Don't fear. That's important. He's telling them to have courage. And then Jesus says, literally, I am. It's me. I am. I am. The same exact thing that God said to Moses when Moses asked, who should I tell the people of Israel that you are? Now, he might have said, I am, in Greek, or some other way that was similar to that, but it's hard for us to read this and see what's going on with Jesus walking on water, telling his people not to be afraid, and not understanding, and probably in the disciples' mind, looking back and realizing, he just claimed to be God, like walking on the water. And of course he did. That's exactly what he's doing. He's claiming to be God. He's claiming to be the I am. God says to Moses, I am who I am. And he says, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent you. And then, of course, he's walking on water, which, again, is just a bizarre, weirdo thing. Like, why is Jesus doing this? But we're also told in Job chapter 9, verse 8, God alone stretches out the heavens, and he tramples on the waves of the sea. Or you can also look at Psalm chapter 77, verses 16 and 19. The psalmist says, when the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters, and yet your footprints were unseen. And I could go to several other passages, but the Bible in the Old Testament talks about God as one who walks upon the waters. And so not only is God providing for his people in the wilderness through his son, he's now walking on water in the middle of a crazy storm. The storm is terrifying, afraid, and we're told that weather is afraid of God. Jesus reveals himself through this insane situation that he puts his disciples in. All right, now let's look at verses 28 through 36, the saving. And Peter answered him, Lord, if it is you, command me to come out to you on the water. And he said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink. He cried out, Lord, save me. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and he took hold of him, saying to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshipped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. I'll stop there for now. Jesus saves Peter. He saves the disciples who've been fighting all night in this storm that he put them in the middle of. Notice what Peter's one of those characters that you love, you see yourself in, and you also realize this guy. He people debate whether or not what Peter did here was a good thing, a bad thing. But I'm quite confident that Jesus was happy with Peter in this situation. Because Peter sees Jesus, and he knows up to this point that Jesus has told the disciples when he commissioned them back in like chapter 10, he said, you'll be able to do all the things that I can do. You'll be able to do miracles. You'll be able to cast out demons and heal people and all of that. He told the disciples that. And so Peter, when he sees this situation, he says, according to the ESV here, he says, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Another translation, and probably a better translation of this that some translations have, is it's a conditional sentence that can also be just more easily translated, Lord, since it is you, command me to come out on the water. So Peter at this point knows it's Jesus. He believes. He's not asking if it's Jesus. He's saying, since you can walk on water, and you've told me to be like you, tell me to walk on water. And of course, Jesus says, yeah, come on, get out. He commands him. So this is now, it was an invitation by Peter, but Jesus tells Peter to do it. So again, Peter's getting put into a situation by Jesus, put into a dilemma by Jesus. Peter gets out on the water. He starts to walk towards Jesus miraculously. Just this morning, one of my kids said, like, how cool would that be? How fun would that be? I don't even know, like, if you're, like, riding up and down on the waves or if there's, like, a platform and you kind of, like, walk and you're just, like, really buoyant. Like, I can't even imagine, like, what this would be like. It's like a trampoline that you're kind of flopping around on and you got to, I don't know. But anyway, Peter gets out on the water He's walking towards Jesus. He's doing what Jesus told him. He's obeying Jesus. And then he gets distracted. And he looks around in the middle of the situation, trying to obey Jesus. And he looks at, the passage tells us specifically, the wind. I don't know, it must have been crazy winds or something. I would have been more worried about the waves. But he sees the wind. Maybe the wind blowing the water or something, I don't know. And the wind terrifies him. He stops looking at Jesus. He stops approaching Jesus. He starts to sink. He's afraid. His attention is divided, no longer focusing on Jesus alone, but on everything around him. He ends up in a situation where he's sinking, and he's terrified, and he does one of the best things you can do in a situation like that. He yells, "Lord, save me. Lord, save me." And of course, Jesus created this situation. Jesus wanted him in this situation, and Jesus immediately grabs his hand and helps him. He saves him. Jesus does save him. And yet, Jesus kind of rebukes him a little bit. He says, like, you got here. You made it so far. You got out of the boat. You did the hard part. Like, you overcame your fears to get in the water. Like, most people don't even get started. Like, the fear prevents them from going, prevents them from, like, becoming a Christian, from taking a step of faith, from doing what God wants them to do to begin with. Just yesterday, we were out actually in Lake Michigan swimming off the seawall that, like, you're not supposed to. And one of my kids was going to jump in the water, and I have the same problem. Just getting up the guts to actually jump is the hardest part. Once you're in and you're swimming and everything, it's fine. Like, it doesn't, I mean, you're not really afraid unless you can't swim, I guess. But the act of jumping is normally the big thing. Peter here did the act of jumping and was walking when he lost it. And this is the way I think it often is for us as believers, too. I think we can relate to this because we try to follow God. We take a step of faith. We end up in the middle of a situation that we wouldn't have gone into on our own if it weren't for Jesus. And that's when we start to lose our trust. That's when we get distracted by the situation itself. The problems, the pain, the difficulty. And yet, here, Peter calls out to Jesus like he should, and Jesus saves him. And then the most miraculous thing happens. They're together. He's got a hold of him. They walk over. They get back into the boat, and then calm ceases. Wind ceases. Everything is perfect. And as we saw, the only kind of person who can do that with water, with the weather, with the water, with the food, that's God. So the disciples rightly say, "Truly, you are the Son of God." And they worship him. Notice this. Again, like we talked about when we were looking at the Nicene Creed, only God can be worshiped. The fact that the Holy Spirit sometimes is worshiped without God rebuking people is evidence that the Holy Spirit is God. The fact that Jesus here is worshiped without rebuking his people is evidence that Jesus here is God. And so, Jesus is recognized as something unique, the Son of God. Obviously, the disciples don't have full understanding here. We're going to see them bumble around for a while. They don't understand God's plan. They don't know what Jesus is here to do yet, but they know now he is unique. He's divine. He's the Son of God in some way, and they're worshiping him, making this confession. But I think something we see from each one of these stories is that Jesus, again, reveals himself repeatedly as the Son of God. He reveals who he is by saving his people, by helping his people to endure, by getting his people through the situations that he puts them in when they're obedient to him. Now, the last little section here, I'll just read this quickly. Starting in verse 34, it says, "And when they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret. And when the men of that place recognized him, they sent around to all that region and brought to him all who were sick and implored him that they might only touch the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched it were made well." This is like the lady who had the continuous bleeding who just touched the hem of Jesus' garment and was healed. And here we see that there's a lot of those. There's large crowds. Jesus shows up on the other side, and again, this is Gennesaret, so it's just a little bit. He's going back, I guess, from your side. He's going back this way along the top of the shore. They cross the water, and they end up just south of the town that he had, like, made his headquarters of Capernaum. So Gennesaret is just right next to Capernaum, just slightly south there on the Sea of Galilee. And the people see him, They notice who he is because he's been around a lot, and they get word out, hey, Jesus is back, bring all the sick people, bring everybody, everybody come, Jesus is back. And of course, he loves them, he has compassion on them, he cares for this crowd, and he heals them. But even the people who have just a little bit of faith, who just want to get close enough, who just want to touch him, are healed. And I think this is important because this is something else that Matthew repeatedly says throughout his gospel, and this is what Jesus, through Matthew, wants us to know, is that he isn't a God who just came for like the most religious people. He's not a God who just came for the most important people. If you look at this story, just the stories we saw today, he hung out with crowds. Now, the religious leaders back then would not have done anything that Jesus is doing here, because, like, who knows? Like, these crowds are all touching him. Like, some of them could have been unclean. Some of them could have been sinners. They might have been Gentiles. Jesus doesn't care. Like, all those people, they care who touches them. They care who's around them. They're too good for certain people. But Jesus isn't like that. Jesus lets the whole crowd come. He feeds the whole crowd. He lets the whole crowd touch him, sick, not sick. Diseases that would generally make you unclean, Jesus is fine with that. Notice he also feeds men. We saw 5,000 of them. But then, specifically, women and children. God takes care of all people, the whole family, everyone. And then he even cares about his leaders and Peter when he saves him. Whether you're the lowest child or one of his lieutenants that he's training to lead his church, Jesus cares. And he heals. And his grace, Jesus' grace, is available to anyone. Big, small, important, not important, by human standards, Jesus takes care of it. He cares, he loves, he heals. So what do we learn from this passage? I think if we look at each one of these, the same pattern is true. Jesus loves people. He heals people. He cares for people. He started this text by caring for the people that came to him when he wanted to be by himself. He ends it by caring for all the people, whoever they are, who come to him, who even just want to touch him. And yet in the middle, we've seen that, like, repeatedly, he takes his own people and he puts them in situations that are very, very hard. He expects trials. He causes trials. He puts them in that situation. And yet he saves them even in the midst of those trials. And so, like the disciples or like Peter, I think it's easy for us to get distracted by the situations of life that we're in when we try to follow him and we get disillusioned, like a athlete might with their coach. Like, why? I hate this guy. Like, why is he making me run? I just want to go play the game that I came here to play. As believers, Jesus loves us so much that he puts us into situations so that we have to really trust him. We have to really get to know him better. He doesn't just work everything out perfectly the first time. And he reveals himself even more fully to you as you trust him by faith in the situations he puts you in. And if you're not a Christian here today, or you haven't trusted Jesus for the first time, I hope it's clear to you from this that whoever you are, whatever your background is, Jesus is there to save you too, just like these people. He doesn't reject people who come to him. No one got rejected. Even the people that just walked up and touched him got healed. And he can do that for you too, if you want him to. He saves really anyone. He's ready to save anyone who comes to him and asks, who just wants to touch him. Please pray with me. Father, I thank you for this day. I thank you for Jesus. We thank you for the salvation that he gives us. We thank you for the ability to know him. And we praise you that even in the midst of knowing him and obeying him, that he cares for us. And he cares for us like you do, like parents who want to discipline their children, like coaches who want to have teams that perform well. We praise you, Father, that you don't just give us everything that we want immediately, but you discipline us, you provide for us, and you want us to know you and to trust you and to look for you for salvation. Lord, I pray that you would teach each one of us to trust you this week. And if there is anyone here who does not know Jesus, Father, I pray that you would save them. I pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this week's sermon from Bethany. We invite you to worship together with us on Sundays. For more information, visit BethanyChicago.org.